May it please the court, counsel. My name is Catherine Elrich, and I do represent the appellants in this case, Galen Brotherson, Judy K. Brotherson, Ryan Durant of San Marante, Michael Wilcox, and Gene Wazilski. This appeal concerns the erroneous denial of a special appearance for these individuals who are non-residents of Texas, the residents of Arizona and Nebraska. These non-resident individuals were brought into this lawsuit concerning a dispute over an agreement between Springbrook Apartments, LTD, which I'll refer to as Springbrook, the appellee, and then two other entities, Tapestry Group, which I'll refer to as Tapestry, and Tapestry Springbrook Apartments, which I'll refer to as Tapestry Springbrook. The specific agreement in dispute involved a note, which was a surplus cash note, which was issued in relation to the Tapestry's purchase of this property, which was out in Louisiana. Tapestry Springbrook was also referenced as a subsidiary of the Tapestry note, was bound by the terms of the note. Now, Mr. Galen Brotherson signed that note on behalf of Tapestry as its president and then on behalf of Tapestry Springbrook as the managing member only, and no other individual signed that note. Now, a dispute arose over the alleged failure of the Tapestry Group to perform under the note. And rather than limit the lawsuit only to the entities under the note, the appellee Springbrook dragged the individuals into this lawsuit. None of these individuals had any connection with Texas. They have no property here, no business here, and telling, they even brought some of the wives in who had absolutely no relation to the companies at all. Now, Springbrook does not contest any of the lack of minimum contacts on these individuals. They only contest that a form selection clause applies, and they only state that the form selection clause applies to these individuals with respect to a judicial estoppel argument. Now, Springbrook wants to ignore the special appearance and not even apply its well-established standard of review, and they just want to hone in on the judicial estoppel theory out of any sort of context. But as the briefing shows, the judicial estoppel theory ultimately fails. It must be analyzed in the special appearance context brought before the trial court. And in doing so, you'll see that the judicial estoppel theory should not be applied, which would then allow the court to review and examine the evidence de novo, since there was never any refuting evidence or challenges to the evidence that...
Well, if you're judicially estopped from taking a position, then the trial court doesn't reach the merits, right? And that's the whole doctrine of judicial estoppel, is that you're estopped from taking the position that you're taking.
Your Honor, yes, but it still must be applied in the context here with respect to the special appearance. We still need to look at the special appearance and the judicial estoppel and determine whether or not that judicial estoppel theory was A, pled and met, thereby meeting that burden of proof of pleading that jurisdictional allegation of judicial estoppel, and then two, proven and met all the elements of judicial estoppel. And as the briefing shows, and as I will argue to an argument, that judicial estoppel theory was neither pled nor were all the elements met, which was plaintiff's burden of proof. With respect to the burdens of proof, the Texas Supreme Court recently issued an opinion in 2010 called Kelly versus General Interior Construction, Inc., and it gives a really great explanation of the shifting of burdens of proof, which has been applied before but not explained quite so well as this Texas Supreme Court opinion sets out. And basically, whether you're looking at a judicial estoppel theory or application of a form selection clause or minimum context analysis or alter ego, veil-piercing jurisdiction theory, whatever your jurisdictional theory is, the plaintiff does bear the burden of to actually allege those theories. Then the burden shifts to the defendant to negate all bases of personal jurisdiction. Now, Springbrook failed to plead sufficient facts to meet its initial burden of proof to bring these individual appellants within the Texas jurisdiction. And what are we need to go look at the original petition to determine what facts were pled. Well, first, they plead that this suit is for, among other things, a collection of amounts due under a note. Jurisdiction is proper because plaintiff seeks money damages from the defendants in an amount that exceeds the minimum jurisdictional limits of the court.
Counsel, you're not suggesting that they had a duty to plead judicial estoppel in an original petition. Before a special appearance was even filed?
Yes, Your Honor, because they were relying on the forum selection clause, and they well knew that the defendants had not signed this forum selection clause. What they did plead was that there was an agreement for venue in Tarrant County, and then that agreement, there was no, that agreement was not with the individual defendants, only the corporate entities, which the corporate entities, by the way, did not file a special appearance. They're here ready and willing to answer the dispute. So we would contend under the Kelly case that they need to allege those jurisdictional facts, judicial estoppel or alter ego or whatever they may be. Well, they did not do that. So our burden was then to present any evidence refuting the jurisdictional facts alleged, which we did. And then we went beyond that. So even if the court was to find that no, their forum selection or the allegation that there was a forum selection clause in the agreement is enough, we went beyond that and refuted the forum selection clause even applies to the individual defendants, as well as refuted the judicial estoppel theory. And in so doing, with respect to the judicial estoppel theory, I'd like to first mention that Springbrook alleges an incorrect standard of review. Springbrook advocates that we don't look at the special appearance at all. We just use an abuse of discretion standard of review. But if you look at the cases which we've outlined in our reply brief that they cite for that, all of the standards of reviews that the courts apply to the judgment being appealed. So if it's a summary judgment and there happens to be a judicial estoppel theory asserted, they still apply the de novo standard of review. So in whatever context that judicial estoppel theory is being applied, you look at the standard of review for that particular judgment. So here we've got a special appearance to which they assert a judicial estoppel theory. In the special appearance context, the standard of review is a de novo review of any application of law. So whether the facts are enough to support the jurisdiction, that would be reviewed under a de novo standard review by this court. And then if there's factual disputes, then the reviewing court is to review that for factual sufficiency of the evidence. As we've asserted in our special appearance brief, as well as in our appellant's brief and reply brief, Springbrook failed to meet all the elements of the judicial estoppel theory, which is the only theory that they rely on. The elements in particular that they fail to meet is that they fail to show that the statements were not inadvertent or mistaken, and they fail to show that the statements were deliberate, clear, and unequivocal. With respect to the statements being clear, direct, and unequivocal, this is very important because we're talking about a waiver of someone's constitutional due process rights here. And if you look at the focus of the hearing and the papers in Arizona, the focus there was on the parties to the note. The parties to the note were Tapestry and Tapestry Springbrook. And Springbrook even admits in its appellee's brief that there could be some equivocation with respect to the language used at the hearing and in the papers filed in Arizona with respect to the parties and the parties to the note. What Springbrook hangs its hat on is statements made about all claims being dismissed and the alter ego claim that was referenced at the hearing in Arizona. But the problem there is those statements can be nothing more than just mistake or inadvertence of counsel. The main focus when you look at the transcript at the hearing was on Tapestry. When you look at the face of the petition in Arizona, the complaint, you see that four of the five claims pled were as to Tapestry, the corporate entities. And even in the reply brief filed by the Brothersons, as well as Tapestry, they make this statement: those defendants who read and agreed to the terms of the agreement reasonably expected that if any dispute arose on the basis of the promissory note, such dispute would be litigated in Texas. Well, those defendants who read and agreed to the note were Tapestry and Tapestry Springbrook, not the individuals. And interestingly, if you look at the
transcript of the hearing that's attached to Appley's brief, the attorney specifically makes reference to the fraud, to the tort claims.
Yes, Your Honor.
And those tort claims only go to the non-signatories to the note, correct?
No, Your Honor. Actually, they had a fraud claim, a negligent misrepresentation claim that went to Tapestry and Tapestry Springbrook. The only claim that was to the individual defendants was an alter ego claim.
And they said, and the attorney represented just referred to in the previous sentence is the alter ego claims, and then goes on to say all these claims should have been brought in Tarrant County. How is that an inadvertent statement?
Your Honor, when you look, that is true that he does say that. And when you look at the claims in total or the transcript in total, you see that the court is focused more, though, on the corporate entities and not so much on these alter ego claims. And we would just contend that was just mistaken and inadvertence of counsel, because these individuals were not signers of the note. And when you look at the order of dismissal in Arizona, I think it's very interesting to see that even the court, you can tell, was somewhat confused in the sense that the order says that it considered defendants Tapestry Group, Inc.'s motion to dismiss. It doesn't say that it considered the individual appellant's motion to dismiss, or anyone else's. It just says defendants Tapestry Group, Inc.'s motion to dismiss. And then it dismisses the case without prejudice. And then it just mentions that it's going to give effect to the language shall as being mandatory and not discretionary. It doesn't explain how it dismissed the claims of the other defendants. So we really don't have a clear indication on that. And for judicial estoppel to apply, there's got to be more clear, direct, unequivocal statements. And at the Arizona hearing, there just wasn't that. There wasn't a clear delineation between the parties. And it appears that the court then started turning its focus on whether or not this clause was mandatory or discretionary, and instead of, you know, exactly who the clause applies to and who it doesn't apply to.
But the bottom line is the trial court here in Tarrant County made findings of fact and found specifically that the language that you claim is ambiguous in the hearing did apply. So the fact that it's not clear in the record, if it's not clear, the fact that it's not clear in the transcription of the record from Arizona, that's the way the trial court here viewed it, and there's certainly evidence that would support that view of the transcript.
Your Honor, that is correct that the trial court did find that was its interpretation of the Arizona proceeding, but we would contend that was an erroneous interpretation, and it would be considered even an abuse of discretion to misapply the law to the facts. When you take a look at the transcript in total, when you take a look at the pleadings that were filed in Arizona, it just isn't that clear and direct, and at most it's mistaken and inadvertent. So you can also see, too, if you take a look at Ryan Durant's affidavit, he signed two affidavits in Arizona, one in his individual capacity and one as an officer or manager of the entities. Well, as an officer of the entities and on their behalf, he addresses the forum selection clause in the note. But interestingly, in his own individual capacity, he certainly does not. As well as the reply brief of the other folks, they don't even mention the forum selection clause. They rely solely on the lack of personal jurisdiction. Once you get past the judicial estoppel, you can go to the minimum contacts, and we'll rely on our brief. I see that I'm running kind of short on time, but there are clearly no minimum contacts to support specific jurisdiction or general jurisdiction, and that's all outlined very well in the brief, and certainly no evidence to support any alter ego or veil-piercing jurisdiction. Springbrook does make the argument that it would request a remand if the court does get to the jurisdictional minimum contacts analysis. And we would contend that no remand is necessary, that they made a strategic move to only rely on judicial estoppel. They had plenty of time to conduct discovery if they so chose. They set the special appearance hearing. We did not set that hearing. And they failed to present any refuting evidence of the minimum contacts, which they certainly could have argued in the alternative and had an opportunity to do so. They also did not file an affidavit, which would be required for any sort of motion for continuance to conduct discovery on the special appearance. So we would contend that the judicial estoppel theory should not be applied. It wasn't pled as a jurisdictional allegation, and it certainly wasn't proven as required to meet all the elements for the judicial estoppel theory. We also would request that that Springbrook not get a second bite at the apple and be able to conduct discovery to try to refute the minimum contacts, but that the court review de novo the evidence that was presented on the personal jurisdiction and conclude that the trial court erred and should have dismissed these defendants from this lawsuit.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Jennifer Poe and I represent the appellee in this case. I believe the justices have already sort of hit the nail on the head as to exactly what the key issue in this case is, and I didn't hear anything in the appellant's argument, nor is there anything in the brief to explain how repeated statements like there would be no claim for alter ego but the contract with the venue selection clause, that means, quote, all of these claims are related to the underlying contract, which in turn means that the venue selection clause applies with equal force to the tort claims that have been alleged in this case. Going on, again, all of these claims should have been brought in Tarrant County, Texas, which is at the clerk's record at 134, the transcript from the hearing in Arizona. I mean, repeatedly saying all, and if there was any confusion or equivocation about what the word all means, which pretty much by definition is a pretty clear word, the counsel in Arizona was kind enough to enumerate everything that all was, which included the alter ego claim, which could only have been brought against the individual defendants. The fact that they chose to argue that the venue selection clause applied equally to all the claims, including to the ones that were only against the individuals, that is an argument that they made, and they succeeded. And now they come here and say, no, you can't actually sue me in Tarrant County, even though I told you to take that all of those claims and bring them in Tarrant County. Now I'm saying no, which is particularly egregious with regard to the Brothersons, who were residents of Arizona. And as the trial court asked at the hearing below on the special appearance, well, if they didn't want to be sued in Arizona, where did they want to be sued? I mean, they were in their own home backyard, and they instead chose to say, nope, take this case to Texas, take all the claims to Texas. And one can also look at the briefing below in the court in Arizona to recognize that, again, the references to all were not inadvertent. In fact, in the reply brief in support of the motion to dismiss on behalf of the Tapestry and the Brothersons at page 6, which is the clerk's record at page 109, they state, which is a case from Arizona, Bennett clearly supports defendant's position that the forum selection clause applies to all of plaintiff's claims. And in that briefing, they underlined the word all. So not only did they use the word, they emphasized it. So clearly they knew what the claims were. They were asking them to be sent to Texas. The court in Arizona did exactly what they asked it to do. And now they're complaining that they shouldn't be allowed to be sued in Texas. And with regard to the idea that the plaintiffs in this case, appellees, were supposed to anticipate that the defendants were going to take such an egregiously alternate position in this case and plead proactively the application of judicial estoppel in case they were going to try and get out of what they did in Arizona is not supported by any of the case law cited. And in fact, I don't believe that the appellants raised any sort of complaint, either in the trial court or on appeal, that the theory of judicial estoppel wasn't properly asserted below to allow the trial court to consider it. And with regard to the concept of, you know, what is inadvertent, what is unequivocal, the trial court had absolutely, the only evidence before it was the transcript and the briefing. The defendants did not bring forth any affidavits from their counsel in Arizona to suggest, well, I didn't really mean to say all, even though I said it over and over again, or anything to suggest that any sort of mistake occurred, nor could they with as many times as they said it. There's no way it was a mistake. They knew what they were doing. But the only evidence before the trial court was the transcript, and the trial court has every right to look at that evidence and decide as a factual matter, is there any reason to consider that as being some sort of inadvertent? You know, maybe if throughout the transcript there had been references to some claims or these claims and then one reference to all claims, they might have an argument. But instead, all the references are to all claims, all claims, all claims. You know, as I stated earlier, there's nothing equivocal about the word all. And frankly, the use of the word parties, I would suggest, in Arizona, wasn't mistaken or inadvertent. It was very artful. They intentionally muddied the waters to give them the opportunity later to say, oh, well, we didn't mean parties to the case. We meant parties to the note. But putting those references aside, the references throughout the record to all claims are very clear. They're very direct. They are absolutely unequivocal. And there's absolutely nothing to suggest that they were inadvertent. This case, in terms of the judicial estoppel cases that have been cited to this court, This case is in line with the Glidewell case, in which in one matter there were two cases going on, an accounting and a partition case, and one of the parties in the partition case said, let's consolidate these, and the other party said, oh, no, they're not related to each other at all. They shouldn't be consolidated. And then when the partition case had a judgment, they took that judgment to the accounting case and said, oh, res judicata applies. And the court said, no, you don't get to say in one instance they're not so interrelated, we can't even consolidate them, but on the other hand, they're so interrelated that it's res judicata effect. And what's interesting about the Glidewell opinion is the court didn't require those parties to have said the words in the first instance, this is so not related that it wouldn't have any res judicata effect. You know, it doesn't have to be that specific. You can take logical inferences from the statements that are made. Just as in this case, there's no reason that the defendants would have had to say in Arizona, yes, Mr. Court in Arizona, we will not challenge personal jurisdiction if you send this case to Texas. What they said was, send all the claims to Texas. That's where they belong. The venue selection clause applies equally to all of them. And the court said, okay, that's what it did. And now the plaintiff would absolutely be prejudiced if the defendants, the appellants in this case, were allowed to go back on that. I suppose they would have to go back and refile in Arizona their alter ego claim against the Brothersons and presumably go someplace else to file their alter ego claim against the other defendants, which is not what judicial economy or judicial estoppel, the doctrine would suggest, is required. With regard to the argument that if the judicial estoppel doctrine doesn't bar the defendants from even raising the issue of personal jurisdiction, that the case should not be remanded, Justice Walker absolutely pointed out, the court didn't reach that issue. The court recognized the judicial estoppel concept as a threshold issue. And what the plaintiffs asked below is, if the judge wasn't going to accept that, if she was going to then reach the merits of the special appearance, to give them the opportunity to conduct discovery. But judicial economy would suggest if you're going to reach on the threshold issue, you don't need to do a full analysis of the minimum context analysis. So there's absolutely no reason for this court to reach an issue that the trial court below didn't reach in the first place. If, for some reason, this panel determines that judicial estoppel should not bar this use of inconsistent statements to gain an unfair advantage, then the case should be sent back to the trial court to let the trial court have the opportunity to make the determination on minimum context and to give the plaintiffs the opportunity to do whatever discovery they might suggest would be necessary to address that analysis. With regard to the question of whether the court's order in Arizona is clear, I would suggest that that's not the standard for judicial estoppel. The standard for judicial estoppel in terms of clarity are the statements made by the party who has now changed positions. And again, going back to the basic concept of saying all claims, all claims, all claims, that's pretty clear and direct. There's nothing to suggest that the defendants in Arizona ever made any attempt to suggest to the court in Arizona, all claims means all claims except this one, which we would like you to still dismiss, but we're not going to agree to let that proceed in Texas. If the justices have no other questions, I believe that pretty much covers our position. It's pretty straightforward. The trial court had absolutely the right to look at the evidence, which is effectively the transcript and the pleadings from Arizona, interpret the statements made therein, that the statement all claims means exactly what it says, that that's what the defendants in Arizona asked for, that's what they got, and now they should not be allowed under the doctrine of judicial estoppel to change their positions to the unfair advantage of the appellee, Springbrook.
What's your response? Before you get started, let me ask you, are you familiar with this court's opinion in Goldman versus White Rose Distributing Company?
Yes, Your Honor. It was cited in our briefs. And in that case, I believe that the court did make the mention that attorney statements made can judicially estop. Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And we don't take the position that the attorney statements made in Arizona couldn't, that it would have to come from one of the parties. We do recognize that certainly attorneys are officers of the court and should make their positions clear. But unfortunately, in the Arizona case, the positions weren't clearly set, and we would contend that they were not clear and direct and unequivocal to meet the judicial estoppel elements, as well as they would have been at most mistaken and inadvertent. With respect to opposing counsel's arguments, I would like to direct the court, first of all, to the reply that Tapestry made. They did state that tort claims would apply to the forum selection clause, but again, as we discussed, Justice Walker, there were tort claims pled against the corporate entities, and so in that reply brief, they focus on the negligent misrepresentation and the fraud claims. Well, those claims were pled as to the corporate entities. They weren't pled to the individuals. There was not a mention in the reply brief of the alter ego claim, although as we've stated, there was certainly a mention by counsel, and we do concede that there was a mention by that counsel in Arizona that he does refer to the alter ego claim at the hearing, but we would argue that that was a mistake and inadvertence of the counsel in making that statement. And we would also urge the court to take a look at the transcript and see that they were really focused on the corporate entities at that hearing, and rightly so, because the corporate entities were the ones that were responsible for the no, not these individuals, and certainly not individuals like Mrs. Brotherson, who was the wife, who had absolutely nothing to do with these corporations and absolutely had nothing to do with the note. Many of these individuals had never seen the note, or some of whom were not even involved with the company when the note was executed. So these folks were just dragged into this lawsuit unnecessarily, and only with respect to one claim, this alter ego claim, which we would contend was more of a peripheral claim and not the focus of the Arizona proceedings. Now, counsel also mentioned that the argument with respect to the pleading was not raised before the trial court when considering the special appearance. However, I would direct the court to the record, the second volume clerk's record, page 189, where in our brief in support of the special appearance, there was an allegation made that there were no jurisdictional allegations made by plaintiff, and the only duty that the defendants then had was to assert that they were a non-resident. With respect to the Glidewell case, we have distinguished that case in our brief, and that was there certainly more direct statements, and there was one party on each side, and not confusion like in this case where there were multiple parties, and the defendants in Arizona being more focused on the corporate entities, the true parties of the note. Once you get past the judicial estoppel argument and you go to the minimum contact, Springbrook has advocated that more of a piecemeal approach to this litigation, that the court should look at judicial estoppel, decide it, even go all the way up to the Court of Appeals, and then come back down to the trial court and then decide the minimum contacts. And they say that that's a more economical approach, but we would contend that the Texas Supreme Court has cited, which we cited a case in our brief, that it does not advocate such piecemeal litigation, and it certainly could have presented in the alternative evidence in support of their position on the minimum contacts. Because the evidence was not refuted on the minimum contacts and on personal jurisdiction, the court has before it everything it needs to do a de novo review of those contacts. And in so doing, this court should find that there was no personal jurisdiction on these individual appellants, and we would request a reversal and rendering and dismissal of these non-residents who were not even parties to the note in dispute. If there are no further questions, I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Your case is submitted.
Thank you.
I appreciate you coming here to argue.